published a front-page story under the headline, "Extreme Climate Change Has Arrived in America." To make its point, the paper prominently displayed the maps you see reproduced in Figure 1.3, which depicted, in flaming reds and oranges, the county-by-county change in temperature across the contiguous United States between 1895 and 2018. The article frames the discussion in the context of a warming globe. Yet any careful reader would notice that some population centers, such as New York City, Los Angeles, and Phoenix, have warmed much faster than the rest of the country. And some blotches in the Rocky Mountain states coincide with areas of new oil and gas production. More expert readers would know that temperature trends due to a changing global climate are smooth over much larger distances than the blobs on these maps. You know it too. Remember Hansen and Lebedev's 1,200 kilometers? So how could New York City have warmed so much more rapidly than a region in central New York State, 250 kilometers, 150 miles, away? Buried deep within the article, one finds urban heat effects, changing air pollution levels, ocean currents, events like the Dust Bowl, and natural climate wobbles such as El Nino could all be playing some role, experts say. In fact, while the article might have you believe otherwise, the Post's maps do not illustrate the arrival of extreme climate change. The localized blobs in these maps are not due to global climate changes, but instead are very likely the result of urbanization or the growth of human activities in rural areas that began producing oil and gas. In other words, the local climates of these areas may indeed have changed since the Industrial Revolution. Yet despite the article's frequent mention of greenhouse gases, these local changes have very little to do with global influences like these. For instance, carbon dioxide, the most important human-influenced greenhouse gas, exists in the atmosphere at roughly the same concentration all over the globe. Figure 1.4, a chart I often use in my lectures, shows the annual average temperatures measured at West Point and Central Park, New York City, 70 kilometers, 42 miles, apart. The, not quite perfectly, correlated fluctuations are clear, as is the warming influence of urbanization in the New York City record in the 40 years after 1920. West Point was and remains relatively rural. As you can see, while temperatures are indeed different in the two locations, their fluctuations pretty well match in both direction and size, just as Hansen and Lebedev would predict. Of course, if we took two stations very far apart, say New York City and Beijing, the fluctuations wouldn't match up at all. Avoiding confusion of local and global effects is why professionals routinely smooth maps of temperature changes over distances of 1,200 kilometers, 750 miles. One of my students would not fare well if they produced a map like the Post's without explaining which warming is due to a changing global climate and which isn't. The varying trends of the global temperature anomaly in Figure 1.1 are thought to have several different causes. One is that the climate system shows internal variability, ebbs and flows over decades, largely associated with slow ocean currents. Then there are natural phenomena, like changes in the sun's brightness, that force, influence, the climate system to change. And finally, and of greatest interest to us, there are those changes and trends that might be in response to forcing from human activities. Although the word forcings might seem odd, in the language of climate science, it is more or less the rigorous-sounding synonym for influences. Climate change versus a changing climate. Using the term climate change promotes, and sometimes perhaps deliberately exploits, a confusion of meaning. The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change defines climate change as a change of climate which is attributed directly or indirectly to human activity that alters the composition of the global atmosphere and which is in addition to natural climate variability observed over comparable time periods. That definition explicitly excludes changes due to natural causes, which differs from the plain language meaning of the term. So when the average person hears climate change, as in the commonly shouted credo, climate change is real, they are likely to assume it means change we are responsible for. The media is not particularly precise or consistent in their usage of the term, sometimes employing it one way and other times another, often without clarification. Articles about changes due to multiple or unknown causes get climate change headlines, and calls to fight climate change make it sound as if reducing human influences would keep the climate from changing. To avoid confusion, this book will be specific and precise and avoid ambiguous language. If we are talking about changes in response to human influences, we will use a phrase like human-caused climate change. Along those same lines, a changing climate will mean just what it sounds like, referring to changes from any source. Precise terminology is one of the most powerful tools a scientist has for reasoning and communicating clearly, while imprecise terminology is just as powerful a tool for those seeking to persuade. As we'll see in the next chapter, human influences on the climate were negligible prior to 1900. There weren't many people around in 1900, only one-fifth of today's count, and they were mostly farming. Industrialization was just getting underway for most of the globe. Human influences remained quite small as late as 1950, when they were less than one quarter of what they are today. Variations in the climate before 1950, then, show that other phenomena must have been at play, if not dominant, since the Earth actually cooled a bit between 1940 and 1980, even as warming human influences grew. And since those natural variations, both internal variability and natural forcings, are presumably still present, it is vitally important to understand them if we're to have confidence in attributing even part of the recent warming to human influences, much less project how the climate will change in the future. Another point worth noting as we consider the recent temperature rise is that, despite the misleading figure 1.3, the warming of the past 40 years on large scales hasn't been uniform over the globe. That's evident in figure 1.5, reproduced from the U.S. government's 2017 CSSR, Climate Science Special Report, described earlier. As you can see, the land is warming more rapidly than the ocean surface, and the high latitudes near the poles are warming faster than the lower latitudes near the equator. More generally, the coldest temperatures, at night, during the winter, and so on, are rising more rapidly than the warmest temperatures. The climate is getting milder as the globe is getting warmer. So what? You might wonder. The Earth is getting warmer. Why does it matter if that warming hasn't been steady or uniform over the globe? Or that low temperatures are rising more rapidly than the high ones? But details like these are important. They help us isolate and quantify the relative roles of human-caused and natural changes, both in the past and in the coming decades. They also help us to understand the impacts of a changing climate. How have ecosystems changed already as the globe has warmed? How have societies adapted to the climate changes we've already seen? And how adaptable might they be to future changes? As in all science, the details deepen our understanding of what's happening, why it's happening, and what might happen in the future. Of course, there's much more to climate than changes in the surface temperature, or even changes throughout the atmosphere. In fact, the atmosphere is a relatively minor part of a much larger and more complex system that includes the water, oceans, lakes, and so on, snow and ice on land and sea, the solid Earth, and living things, microbes, plants, animals, and humans. The world's oceans are both the most important and the most problematic piece of the Earth's climate system. They hold more than 90% of the climate's heat and are its long-term memory. Conditions in the atmosphere swing wildly from day to day and year to year in response to any number of influences. That's part of what makes untangling weather and climate so difficult. The oceans, on the other hand, change and respond to changes over decades to centuries. Yet, as mentioned, gathering ocean data with enough precision and coverage to detect climate changes is even more of a challenge than it is on land. The oceans are vast and largely unpeopled, and while the near surface is accessible, the depths are far less so. The average ocean depth is 3,700 meters, or 12,000 feet. Satellites can measure the temperature only at and above the ocean surface, and they have been doing even that for less than half a century. Before satellites, there were only surface measurements or soundings from passing ships, which don't go everywhere, and buoys, which are at few fixed locations. In 2000, an international program called ARGO began setting a fleet of robotic floats adrift on the oceans to record their properties. The ARGO float system first achieved worldwide coverage in 2005, and there are now more than 3,900 of those drifters covering the world's oceans. The floats usually drift at a depth of 1 kilometer, 3,300 feet, but every 10 days, they descend to more than 2 kilometers, 6,600 feet, and measure the temperature and salinity profile through the water column during a 6-hour ascent to the surface, where they transmit their results via satellite before returning to 1 kilometer depth. ARGO has vastly improved our knowledge of ocean conditions. Before the year 2000, no more than 40% of the ocean had been sampled to 400 meters, 1,300 feet, and less than 10% had been sampled below 900 meters, 3,000 feet. Remember, the average ocean depth is 3,700 meters. ARGO improved coverage dramatically during the past 2 decades, and some 60% of the ocean is now being sampled at least yearly to a depth of 2 kilometers. While ARGO data will be essential to understanding changing ocean conditions in the coming decades, data on the ocean's past is limited in coverage and quality. Even so, we're confident that the oceans have been warming over decades, if not centuries. Figure 1.6 is another anomaly graph, this time showing how the heat content of various layers of the ocean has increased over the past 60 years. The heat energy is measured in zeta joules. 1 zeta joule is equal to 10 to the 21st joules, and the anomalies are relative to a 1958 to 1962 baseline. The dashed lines give the 95% confidence interval of the ocean's total heat. In other words, the graph says that there is a 95% chance that the true value falls within those dashed lines. The lines are farther apart, further back in time, because we have less reliable information then, making the uncertainties greater. There is a clear upward trend in the ocean's heat energy, with the upper 300 meters, 1,000 feet, warming more rapidly than the deeper layers, as would be expected if heat is being absorbed from the warming surface. In contrast, the slowly changing deeper layers better reflect past conditions. Hundreds of zeta joules sounds like a lot of energy, and it is, at least on a human scale. All of the world's energy derived annually from fossil, nuclear, and renewable sources amounts to only about 0.6 zeta joules. However, when that heat is spread out over all the water in the oceans, the temperature rise it represents is very modest, a few hundredths of a degree Celsius per decade. Nevertheless, the growing ocean heat content is the surest indication that the planet has indeed been warming in recent decades. But lest you think the matter is settled, consider that a different peer-reviewed analysis found that the heat content increased between 1990 and 2015 at only half the rate shown in Figure 1.6, with the same smaller rate of increase also between 1921 and 1946, when human influences on the climate were much smaller. And yet another paper found that the upper 2 kilometers of ocean warmed from 1750 to 1950 at a rate about one-third of that shown in the figure. So as with the surface temperature record, poor historical data and large natural variability complicate efforts to understand the role of human influences. Rising temperatures at the surface and in the ocean are not the only indicators of recent warming. The ice on the Arctic Ocean and in mountain glaciers has been in decline, and growing seasons have been lengthening slightly. Satellite observations show that the lower atmosphere is warming as well. Later chapters will discuss some of these indicators in more detail. But to what extent are human influences driving this warming? One clue involves looking at the climate centuries or more in the past, when human influences were truly negligible. We've already seen that there were significant trends in ocean heat well before we came on the scene. What did the global temperature anomaly graph look like before 1850, the earliest date shown in Figure 1.1? Were there long-term rising trends before humans influenced the climate? And how much did the temperature anomaly wiggle over the decades due to natural forcings and/or internal variability? Answers to questions like those are essential to knowing how the climate has already responded to human influences and how it might respond in the future. Although crude thermometers were around in the mid-17th century, Daniel Fahrenheit created the first reliable instrument in just 1714, and these weren't widespread until the mid-1800s. So past climates have to be inferred in other ways. We have historical records, such as weather diaries and crop yields going back a few millennia, though obviously the extent of these varies both from time to time and place to place. But paleoclimatologists can infer climate even further back by using proxies, that is, measuring a temperature-sensitive property of material preserved from the past. One example is the analysis of the thickness and composition of tree rings, which are laid down annually as a tree grows. Another is by temperature measurements of the water in boreholes, holes drilled deep into the ground at various locations around the globe. Just as in the oceans, the deeper water carries information about surface temperatures further in the past. Figure 1.7 shows several different proxy reconstructions of the global temperature anomaly over the past 1,500 years, alongside our modern instrumental record, which begins in the late 1800s. This time, our baseline is the average temperature between 1881 and 1980, represented by the dashed line. As you can see, centuries of warmer temperatures gave way gradually around the year 1000, leading up to the Little Ice Age, an unusually cold period that ran from about 1450 to 1850. This was followed by more rapid warming that has continued until today. Because of the limited evidence, the most recent assessment report, AR5, from which the data in Figure 1.7 is taken, has only low confidence that the global warming of the past 30 years has exceeded the range of reconstructed temperatures. But proxy data are better and more plentiful for the Northern Hemisphere, where there's more land. So AR5 has medium confidence that the last 30 years were likely, a 2 out of 3 chance, the warmest 30-year period of the last 1,400 years for the Northern Hemisphere. What happens if we zoom out to look at even longer timescales? Tree rings go back some 15,000 years into the past, but cores drilled into the ice sheets of the Antarctic or Greenland can take us much further. Those ice sheets build up in layers, year by year, and the properties of each layer, including trapped gases, isotopic composition, and dust, carry information about the climate conditions when it was formed. Analyses of layers deep in these cores can tell us about the distant past. The oldest cores now go back almost 3 million years, and cores into ocean bottom sediments can take us 100 million years into the past. The shells of tiny marine organisms continually rain down from the ocean surface and are deposited on the ocean bottom, creating a continuous record of the conditions under which they were created and grew. None of these proxies for temperature is as good as a direct measurement with a thermometer. They directly reflect conditions at only a single location, and they can be complicated to interpret. For example, tree growth is sensitive not just to temperature, but to precipitation as well. And uncertainties grow as you go further back in time. But proxies do give us a sense of how the climate changed before there were humans systematically observing and recording the weather. Our accumulated knowledge of the Earth's surface temperature over the past 500 million years is summarized in Figure 1.8, which shows global average surface temperature anomalies in degrees Celsius relative to the 1960 to 1990 baseline. There are 5 different panels, each spanning an interval between geologically significant events. The timescale of each successive panel is about 10 times shorter than the one before it. Starting at the right-hand, most recent, panel, we see that the globe warmed about 5 degrees Celsius, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, starting some 20,000 years ago, when ice sheets last covered a large fraction of the Earth. The relatively warm and stable temperature over the past 10,000 years supported the rapid development of civilization. Over the past million years, beginning in the second panel from the right, periods of rapid warming alternated with periods of slower cooling, every 40,000 years or so early on, and then every 100,000 years, starting about 500,000 years ago. Those variations were driven by slight changes in the Earth's orbit around the Sun and the tilt of its axis. The most recent warm period before the present began about 127,000 years ago and lasted for some 20,000 years. During that time, the global surface temperature anomaly was up to 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer, and the upper ocean was 2 to 3 degrees Celsius, 3.6 to 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than today. Going further back in time, as shown in the 3 leftmost panels, there are even stronger swings, some of which have had impacts on the modern world. For example, the Carboniferous period extended from approximately 360 to approximately 300 million years ago, the interval between evolution's invention of trees and its invention of tree rot. Since there was nothing then to consume the wood when trees died, some of the world's great coal deposits were laid down during that time. It's sobering to realize that the entire figure shows only the most recent 10% of the Earth's history, and that anatomically modern humans appeared only in the middle of the second most recent panel, a few hundred thousand years ago. I hope this chapter has given you a new appreciation for some of the many moving parts involved in climate science and in drawing conclusions from it. We've explored these foundational concepts and problems in the context of global warming. Past variations of surface temperature and ocean heat content do not at all disprove that the approximately 1 degree Celsius, 1.8 degree Fahrenheit, rise in the global average surface temperature anomaly since 1880 is due to humans, but they do show that there are powerful natural forces driving the climate as well, and they illuminate the scientific challenge of understanding those natural influences well enough to confidently identify the climate's response to human ones. In other words, as we've made clear throughout this chapter, the real question is not whether the globe has warmed recently, but rather to what extent this warming is being caused by humans. To answer this, we need to know more about how, and how much, humans influence the climate, which is the subject of the next chapter. 2. Humble human influences. Like many people, I keep an eye on my weight. Eating more and exercising less makes me heavier, while eating less and staying active makes pounds disappear. How much I eat and move aren't the only variables. There are factors like health, hormones, and genetics that influence how fast I burn or store calories, but in short, my weight is determined by the balance between calories consumed and calories burned, and any imbalance quickly shows up on the scale. In the same way, the Earth's temperature results from a crucial balance between warming by sunlight and cooling by heat radiated back out into space. On the warming side of this balance is the sunlight energy that the planet absorbs. As the planet heats up, it emits infrared radiation back into space, which makes up the cooling side of the balance. A fundamental physical law, the Stefan-Boltzmann law, discovered around 1880 by two physicists working in Austria, tells us that the amount of infrared radiation an object emits increases with its temperature in a very predictable way. So, as a planet's temperature rises due to solar warming, the cooling by infrared radiation also increases, until the infrared cooling is equal to the solar warming. The technical term for this Goldilocks condition, where the planet is neither gaining nor losing energy and its temperature is steady, is radiative equilibrium. The temperature at which that balance is achieved, the equilibrium temperature, depends upon several things, most obviously the planet's distance from the sun. Let's look more closely at the warming side of the balance, the sunlight energy absorbed. Because the Earth is not completely black, it absorbs only 70% of the sunlight that reaches it. The other 30% is reflected back into space and doesn't contribute to the planet's warming. That 30% number, corresponding to the Earth's reflectivity, is called the albedo, from the Latin word albus, meaning white. When the albedo is higher, the Earth reflects more sunlight, and so is a bit cooler. And conversely, when the albedo is lower, the Earth absorbs more sunlight and is warmer. While the planet's average albedo is 0.30, its value at any given moment depends upon which part of the Earth is facing the sun. Oceans are darker, land is brighter, clouds are brighter still, and snow or ice is very bright. And the monthly average varies by about plus or minus 0.01 with the seasons. It's larger in March and smaller in June/July. Earthshine and the albedo. Precision measurements of the global albedo are important to understanding the climate system. If the average albedo were to increase from 0.30 to 0.31, say because of a 5% increase in cloudiness, that additional reflectivity would largely compensate for the warming influence of doubling the atmosphere's CO2. I developed a personal interest in albedo measurements in the summer of 1991 when I participated, along with physicist Freeman Dyson and astronaut Sally Ride, in a study conducted by JASON, an independent organization of scientists that advises the U.S. government on sensitive and pressing science and technology issues. This study focused on the possible uses of small satellites in observing the climate. One thing such satellites could measure is the fraction of sunlight that a patch of the Earth's surface reflects back into space. With enough satellites covering enough of the globe, we could average those fractions to determine the global albedo. In fact, that's how the albedo has been measured for more than 40 years, except by a few large, expensive satellites instead of many small ones. The JASON study 30 years ago also motivated me to revive an older, simpler way to study the Earth's albedo. The French astronomer André Dangean first measured the Earth's albedo in the early 1930s. His very clever method was to observe Earthshine, the faint glow of the dark part of the lunar disk most visible when the moon is less than half full, as shown in Figure 2.1. As that light stems from sunlight reflected by the Earth and then reflected again by the lunar surface, its brightness depends upon the Earth's reflectivity, and so is a measure of the global albedo. Because Dangean got an implausibly high value for the albedo, 0.39, Earthshine studies became just a curiosity after about 1950. But in the summer of 1991, we Jasons realized that when Dangean's data were reanalyzed, taking into account that the porosity of the lunar surface enhances its reflection of Earthshine, the global albedo came out about right. So I enlisted some astronomer colleagues in a program of modern Earthshine observations beginning in 1995. Among the advantages of measuring albedo via Earthshine is that it requires only a small telescope and standard camera, and that it's self-calibrating, since the brightness of the Earthshine is compared with the sunshine in the same image. That would allow such measurements to be reproduced by future researchers decades or even centuries hence, using whatever instrumentation is available then. Precision climate observations, whether by satellite or other means, often go through a process of successive refinement until researchers get it right. Our Earthshine work was no different. But eventually, we were able to determine annual average albedos accurate to plus or minus 0.003 from 1999 to 2014 that showed no significant trend, in agreement with the satellite values. That uncertainty is about twice that of the satellite-derived values, but at 1/1000th the cost. Understanding changes in the Earth's reflected light visible on the Moon also turns out to be a good test of our ability to study other planets that are orbiting other stars, which are visible through the starlight they reflect. Such are the unexpected connections of science. Knowing the Earth's albedo, as averaged over the globe in daily and seasonal cycles, we can determine its equilibrium temperature by balancing the sunlight absorbed against the infrared cooling. As we discussed, that cooling becomes stronger as the temperature increases. If the Earth gets hotter, it emits more heat, making it a kind of thermostat. Determining the Earth's equilibrium temperature by calculating that balance is a basic problem assigned at the start of every serious climate course. It gives an average surface temperature of minus 18 degrees Celsius, 0 degrees Fahrenheit. But minus 18 degrees Celsius, 0 degrees Fahrenheit, is wrong, far below the Earth's actual global average temperature of 15 degrees Celsius, 59 degrees Fahrenheit. What's missing is the insulation provided by the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which raises our planet's surface temperature to its observed value. How that insulation works is best illustrated by a story. In January 2010, when I was serving as the Department of Energy's Undersecretary for Science, I had the privilege of traveling to the South Pole. The Department of Energy had helped install 3 wind turbines on a ridge between the U.S. McMurdo Station and New Zealand's Scott Base on the periphery of Antarctica. The electricity generated by these turbines would reduce the amount of diesel fuel that had to be brought in by tanker ship. There was to be a ceremonial dedication, and I was part of the delegation doing the honors. I flew from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles, and then on to Christchurch, New Zealand, through Auckland. There, our delegation was fitted with extreme cold weather, ECW, gear, insulated overalls, parka, fleece, heavy boots, woolen cap, gloves, and goggles. The following morning, we boarded a military cargo jet operated by the New York National Guard. The next 5 hours were uncomfortable ones. We had to wear our ECW gear just in case the plane had a problem and we needed to exit in a hurry. That long flight south brought us to the Pegasus runway, about 20 miles across the ice shelf from McMurdo Station. We dedicated the wind turbines that evening, and the next morning we flew further south on a cargo prop plane to visit the pole. The temperature was minus 33 degrees Celsius, minus 27 degrees Fahrenheit. We stayed for 8 hours. I was able to enjoy this amazing experience thanks to the insulation of the cold weather gear, which intercepted my body heat, impeding its flow away from me and into the surrounding air. Just like that cold weather gear, greenhouse gases in the atmosphere intercept and impede the flow of infrared heat from the Earth's surface into space. Some of that heat finds its way back down to the surface, where it causes additional warming, the greenhouse effect, as shown in Figure 2.2. It's often said that greenhouse gases trap heat, which gives the impression that the heat never escapes. But all of the heat must eventually be radiated to space to keep the planet in energy balance, as discussed earlier. The radiated heat must balance the absorbed solar energy very precisely to within less than 0.5%. If it didn't, we'd see the Earth warming or cooling much more rapidly than we do. So when discussing the effect of greenhouse gases on the heat flowing from the Earth's surface, a more appropriate metaphor is catch and release. For this reason, I'll use the terms intercept and impede, rather than trap. The most common of the gases making up the Earth's atmosphere are nitrogen, 78%, and oxygen, 21%. Combined, then, these two account for 99% of the dry atmosphere. And because of the peculiarities of molecular structure, heat passes through them easily. The largest part of the remaining 1% is the inert gas argon. But while even less abundant, some of the other gases, most significantly water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and ozone, intercept, on average, about 83% of the heat emitted by the Earth's surface. So the Earth does indeed emit energy equivalent to what it absorbs from the sun, but instead of directly flowing off into space, cooling our planet to a chilly average of 0 degrees Fahrenheit, much of that energy is intercepted by the atmosphere blanketing us. Water vapor is the most important of the greenhouse gases. Of course, the amount in the atmosphere at any given place and time varies greatly. The humidity changes a lot with the weather. But on average, water vapor amounts to only about 0.4% of the molecules in the atmosphere. Even so, it accounts for more than 90% of the atmosphere's ability to intercept heat. John Tyndall, the Irish physicist who was the first to study the infrared properties of gases, eloquently expressed its importance in an 1863 public lecture. Aqueous water vapor is a blanket, more necessary to the vegetable life of England than clothing is to man. Remove for a single summer night the aqueous vapor from the air which overspreads this country, and you would assuredly destroy every plant capable of being destroyed by a freezing temperature. The warmth of our fields and gardens would pour itself unrequited into space, and the sun would rise upon an island held fast in the iron grip of frost. The next most significant greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, CO2, is different from water vapor in that its concentration in the atmosphere is much the same all over the globe. CO2 currently accounts for about 7% of the atmosphere's ability to intercept heat. It's also different in that human activities have affected its concentration, that is, the fraction of air molecules that are CO2. Since 1750, the concentration has increased from 0.000280, 280 parts per million, or ppm, to 0.000410, 410 ppm, in 2019, and it continues to go up 2.3 ppm every year. Although most of today's CO2 is natural, there is no doubt that this rise is, and has been, due to human activities, primarily the burning of fossil fuels. The CO2 that humans have added to the atmosphere over the past 250 years increases the atmosphere's ability to impede heat, it's like making the insulation thicker, and is exerting a growing warming influence on the climate. The exact increase in insulation at any place and time depends upon temperature, humidity, cloudiness, and so on. Taking average clear sky, no clouds, conditions as an example, the CO2 added from 1750 until today increases the fraction of heat intercepted from 82.1% to 82.7%. And as the amount of CO2 continues to increase, the atmosphere's heat intercepting ability, and hence its warming influence, will also increase, doubling the CO2 concentration from the 1750 value of 280 ppm to 560 ppm would increase it to 83.2% under clear sky conditions. Such an increase in concentration would amount to an increase of just 2.8 molecules per 10,000. In other words, an increase of fewer than 3 molecules of CO2 out of every 10,000 molecules of air would increase the amount of heat intercepted from 82.1% to 83.2%, or by about 1%. If you've followed this far, you might be puzzled by two things. First, how could changing fewer than 3 molecules out of 10,000, a 0.03% change, increased the atmosphere's heat intercepting ability by about 30 times that amount, 1%. And second, how could a mere 1% increase in heat intercepting ability be such a big deal? The answer to the first question depends upon the details of the infrared, heat, radiation the planet emits to keep cool. While we've talked about how the overall amount of that radiation has to balance the warming sunlight, the radiation is actually spread over a spectrum of different wavelengths. Think of those like colors, although not visible to our eyes. Water vapor, the most significant greenhouse gas, intercepts only some colors, but because it blocks almost 100% of those it does, adding more water vapor to the atmosphere won't make the insulation much thicker. It would be like putting another layer of black paint on an already black window. But that's not true for carbon dioxide. That molecule intercepts some colors that water vapor misses, meaning a few molecules of CO2 can have a much bigger effect, like the first layer of black paint on a clear window. So the greater potency of a CO2 molecule depends upon relatively obscure aspects of how it and water vapor intercept heat radiation. Another example of why the details are important when attempting to understand human influences on the climate. Figure 2.3 illustrates some of those details. It shows how the amount of heat radiation leaving the top of the atmosphere varies with the radiation's color, that is, the spectrum of infrared radiation. Were there no atmosphere, the spectrum would correspond to the smooth gray line in the graph, a curve which is described by the basic physics of the Stefan-Boltzmann law. The area under that curve corresponds to the cooling power of the radiation. The lighter, jagged gray line shows what the spectrum would look like with all major greenhouse gases present except CO2, so with CO2 at 0 ppm. Combined, these gases reduce the radiation's cooling power by about 12.1%. All of the line's ups and downs arise from the detailed properties of the various greenhouse gas molecules, most importantly water vapor, but also methane and ozone. The solid black line shows a further 7.6% reduction in cooling power, increase in insulation, when CO2 is present at 400 ppm, about today's concentration. Finally, the dashed black line shows an additional 0.8% loss of cooling power when the CO2 concentration is raised to 800 ppm, roughly twice what it is today. This change is barely visible in the sides of the large dip. There are two takeaways from this graph. One is the complexity of the spectra. Hundreds of thousands of molecular properties, many measured in the laboratory, go into creating the simulated spectra, which agree very well with satellite observations. Second, although the effect of CO2 at today's concentration is significant, 7.6%, doubling it doesn't change things much, an additional 0.8%, due to the painting a black window effect we've already discussed. But now let's return to that second question from a bit ago. How could a 1% change in the heat intercepted possibly matter? The IPCC's climate models predict that doubling the CO2 concentration from pre-industrial levels, causing the 1% change in heat intercepting we've discussed, would increase the average surface temperature by about 3 degrees Celsius, 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Since we've said the globe's average surface temperature is 15 degrees Celsius, 59 degrees Fahrenheit, a rise of 3 degrees Celsius would represent a 20% increase in temperature, 3 degrees Celsius out of 15 degrees Celsius. But on the Fahrenheit scale, this same temperature change is 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit from the average of 59 degrees Fahrenheit, a 10% rise. Why should the rise depend upon which temperature scale we use? And in any event, either of these numbers, whether 20% or 10%, seems too large. How could a 1% change in the atmosphere's heat interception produce such an outsized effect? Physicists generally expect changes to be commensurate. A 1% change in heat interception should produce something like a 1% change in temperature, and when they're not, it's a sign that we're missing a piece of the puzzle. In this case, that missing piece is the temperature scale. The Stefan-Boltzmann law, which, as you'll recall from the opening of this chapter, describes the relationship between the heat radiated by the Earth and its temperature, is framed in terms of absolute temperatures, which are measured on the Kelvin scale. Both the Celsius and Fahrenheit scales are anchored to the properties of water, freezing at 0 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and boiling at 100 degrees Celsius, 212 degrees Fahrenheit. The Kelvin scale is anchored to absolute zero, the temperature at which matter is so cold it doesn't emit any heat at all. 0 Kelvin equals minus 273.15 degrees Celsius, or minus 459.67 degrees Fahrenheit. Kelvin degrees are just as large as Celsius degrees, each is 1.8 Fahrenheit degrees. So the Earth's average surface temperature of 15 degrees Celsius, 59 degrees Fahrenheit, corresponds to about 288 Kelvin. A rise of 3 degrees Celsius, or 3 Kelvin, or 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit, in that surface temperature then corresponds to a warming of 3 Kelvin out of 288 Kelvin, or about 1%, in accord with the 1% increase in the atmosphere's ability to intercept heat when the CO2 concentration is doubled. So on the scales that matter to us, the climate system is quite sensitive. The few degree changes in average surface temperature we've seen over the past few centuries, and could see in this one, correspond to physically small, about 1%, influences. That sensitivity greatly complicates the task of figuring out how the Earth will respond to rising greenhouse gas levels, especially since they're not the only influence at work. Understanding how the climate system responds to human influences is, unfortunately, a lot like trying to understand the connection between human nutrition and weight loss, a subject famously unsettled to this day. Imagine an experiment where we fed someone an extra half cucumber each day. That would be about an extra 20 calories, a 1% increase to the average 2,000-calorie daily adult diet. We'd let that go on for a year and see how much weight they gained. Of course, we would need to know many other things to draw any meaningful conclusions from the results. What else did they eat? How much did they exercise? Were there any changes in health or hormones that affect the rate at which they burn calories? Many things would have to be measured precisely to understand the effect of the additional cucumbers, although we would expect that, all else being equal, the added calories would add some weight. The problem with human-caused carbon dioxide and the climate is that, as in the cucumber experiment, all else isn't necessarily equal, as there are other influences, forcings, on the climate, both human and natural, that can confuse the picture. Among the other human influences on the climate are methane emissions into the atmosphere, from fossil fuels but more importantly from agriculture, and other minor gases that together exert a warming influence almost as great as that of human-caused CO2. Not all human influences are warming. Aerosols are fine particles in the atmosphere, such as those produced by the burning of low-quality coal. They cause severe health problems, contributing to millions of deaths per year. But they also make the globe more reflective, both by directly reflecting sunlight and by inducing the formation of reflective clouds. Human-caused aerosols, together with changes in land use like deforestation, pasture is more reflective than forest, increase the albedo and so exert a net cooling influence that cancels about half of the warming influence of human-caused greenhouse gases. Then there are natural forcings. Erupting volcanoes loft aerosols high into the stratosphere, where they remain for several years reflecting a bit more sunlight than usual, and so exerting a cooling influence. Such eruptions are unpredictable, but they're sometimes significant enough to negate human influences completely for a few months, and therefore have to be taken into account. For example, the Earth was about 0.6 degrees Celsius cooler during the 15 months that followed the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in June 1991. And changes in the sun's intensity of even a fraction of a percent over decades, due to its own internal variability, can change the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth, further complicating our attempts to account for all the human and natural forcings affecting the planet's delicate energy balance. But if we're to understand the climate's response to growing CO2 levels, it is important to know what those other influences are, how big they are, and how and when they come into play. The energy that flows in and out of the climate system is measured in watts per square meter. The sunlight energy absorbed by the Earth, and hence the heat energy radiated by the Earth, amounts to an average of 239 watts per square meter. Since a 100-watt incandescent light bulb gives off, well, 100 watts, almost all is heat, this means the planet radiates heat as if there were a bit more than two light bulbs in every square meter, 11 square feet, of its surface. Human influences today amount to just over 2 watts per square meter, or slightly less than 1% of that natural flow, about the same influence as half a cucumber on the daily human diet. People are often curious about heat put into the climate system by two other non-sunlight sources. One is the geothermal heat flowing out of the Earth's surface. While it can be quite large at localized sources, such as volcanoes, hot springs, and vents on the seafloor, the global average of only 0.09 watts per square meter is too small to have a meaningful direct effect on the climate's energy balance. However, there can be indirect effects, such as the melting of ice by subglacial Antarctic volcanoes. Another source of heat input into the climate system is the energy that humans derive from fossil fuels and nuclear material. After that energy is used for heating, mobility, and generating electricity, the second law of thermodynamics guarantees that virtually all of it ends up as heat in the climate system, ultimately to be radiated into space along with the Earth's natural heat emissions. A very small fraction winds up as visible light that escapes directly to space through the transparent atmosphere, but even that ultimately winds up as heat somewhere out there. That human heat can indeed affect the local climate where this energy use is concentrated, for example in cities and near power plants. But averaged over the globe, it currently amounts to only 0.03 watts per square meter, some 10,000 times smaller than the natural heat flows of the climate system, and about 100 times smaller than the other human influences. The totality of human and natural influences on the climate is shown in Figure 2.4. It illustrates much of what we've discussed already. We can see the growth of greenhouse gas warming, predominantly from rising CO2 and methane concentrations, but also other human-emitted greenhouse gases, and that this has been partially offset by growing aerosol cooling. The episodic cooling by large volcanic eruptions is also evident. We can also see that, before 1950, total human influences, the sum of CO2, other GHG, and human cooling, were less than one-fifth of what they are today. Also shown in Figure 2.4 is how uncertain we are about these various forcings. While the warming effects of CO2 and other greenhouse gases are known to within 20%, the uncertainty in the cooling influence of human-caused aerosols is much larger, making the total human-caused forcing uncertain by 50%. That is, the best we can say is that the net human influence today is very likely to be between 1.1 and 3.3 watts per square meter. The fact that human influences currently amount to only 1% of the energy that flows through the climate system has important implications and means there's a lot to understand. To usefully measure them and their effects, we have to observe and understand the larger parts of the climate system, the other 99%, with a precision better than 1%. Small natural influences must also be understood to that same precision, and we've got to be sure they're all accounted for. This is an enormous challenge in a system for which we have limited observations for a limited time, and about which our uncertainties are still large. Comparing climate models with and without these forcings can illuminate the role human influences have played in recent climate changes, as well as suggest how the climate might change in the future as those influences grow. By far the largest human influence on the climate system, and the one nearly all climate policy is focused upon, is the emission of greenhouse gases. But the relationship between our emission of these gases and their influence is more complicated than you might imagine. So before we turn to the models, let's take a closer look at these gases and where they go. 3. Emissions explained and extrapolated. In 2008, I was working as BP's chief scientist, focused on accelerating renewable energy technologies. I was invited to attend a small dinner hosted by Prince Philip at Buckingham Palace. I arrived in black tie at the palace courtyard via London cab. A quick security check, and I was ushered into a reception room, along with other guests. After pre-dinner drinks and small talk, we, a group of about 14 that included Prince Philip, Princess Anne, BP CEO John Brown, and other notables from UK academia, business, and government, moved into a grander room and settled around a large dining table. The chit-chat among tablemates quieted as Prince Philip made his welcome and reminded us that the topic of the evening was climate and energy. He then opened the conversation by asking the group a question about the relationship between carbon dioxide emissions and rising global temperatures. The prince's framing was sufficiently technical that there was awkward silence around the table, until yours truly, the cheeky American scientist, spoke up in a Brooklyn accent to deliver a mini-lecture on infrared active molecules, the black window effect, and the connection between atmospheric concentration and emissions. I earned an appreciative nod from the Duke of Edinburgh, whom I found to be quite knowledgeable. I suspect that the Duke already knew the answer to his conversation-starting question when he asked it. In any event, the lively discussion that followed over a fine dinner mirrored many others that I've been involved in, finding non-experts eager to understand the complex and nuanced subjects of climate and energy, as well as a confusion about the nature and scale of the problems facing us. The most significant human-caused greenhouse gases influencing the climate are carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, CH4. Their concentrations in the atmosphere are increasing because we're emitting them. That's why efforts to reduce human influences on the climate focus on reducing emissions. But here's the key point. The connection between concentrations and emissions isn't a simple one. And particularly for CO2, the complications of this relationship profoundly increase the challenge of reducing the concentration. This chapter is about movement, primarily the movement of carbon. Human-emitted CO2 is a relatively small add-on to a vast natural cycle of carbon moving among the Earth's crust, oceans, plants, and atmosphere. As you will see, our addition to that cycle will increase for decades under any scenario. But despite the precision claimed by climate models, the impact of this on the climate is highly uncertain. Charles David Keeling, a geochemist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, California, began precision measurements of CO2 concentration in the 1950s while he was a postdoctoral researcher at Caltech. One of his early surprises was finding a 1% increase in the concentration between 1957 and 1959. That finding motivated a more concerted, longer-term program to monitor CO2 concentrations, which later expanded to include other gases in the atmosphere. I had the pleasure of talking with Dr. Keeling, Dave, as he was known, some 40 years later during one of my Jason summers in La Jolla. I found him to be a quiet, thoughtful, precise man, focused on doing what he was doing very well, knowing it was important to the world. Figure 3.1 shows what is now called the Keeling curve, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as measured monthly at Mauna Loa, Hawaii. Data from that remote island location, far from significant localized sources that might skew the observations, is a good measure of the globe's background concentration. The measurements show a steady rise from 310 ppm in 1960 to 410 ppm in 2019. During the past decade, the concentration has risen about 2.3 ppm each year. But superimposed on that decades-long trend is an annual cycle. The concentration moves up and down seasonally by 2.4 ppm, as shown in the inset. Both the trend and the cycle, which are measured at a number of locations around the world, help tell a story. Let's start at the beginning. The Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago with a fixed endowment of carbon. Today, that carbon is found in several different circumstances around the planet, what are called reservoirs. The largest reservoir by far is the Earth's crust, which contains almost all of the planet's carbon, about 1.9 billion gigatons. 1 gigaton, abbreviated GT, is 1 billion tons. The next largest amount, about 40,000 gigatons, is in the oceans, almost all of that far below the surface. There are about 2,100 gigatons more stored on land, in soils and living things, and 5,000 to 10,000 gigatons in fossil fuels underground. The roughly 850 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere, almost all in the form of carbon dioxide, is equal to about 25% of the carbon at or near the Earth's surface, in the soils, plants, and shallow ocean, but is only 2% of the total carbon in the oceans. Powerful natural processes move the Earth's carbon among those reservoirs, often by changing its chemical form. The most important of these processes is the seasonal flow of about 1/4 of the atmosphere's carbon to the surface as plants grow. They use photosynthesis to turn atmospheric CO2 into organic matter, then return that carbon back to the atmosphere through respiration and as their organic matter decays. In fact, plant growth in the northern hemisphere is what causes the February to July dip in the Mauna Loa background CO2 concentration, seen in the inset of Figure 3.1. This is the Earth breathing. Other, much slower, processes move carbon from the ocean's surfaces into their depths, and then ultimately into rock, such as the limestone and marble that form from the shells of marine creatures. The CO2 emitted by burning fossil fuels disrupts the balance of this great annual cycle, since that carbon has been pulled out of the deep underground, where it was isolated from these natural processes. The amount of carbon that fossil fuel use adds to the cycle is currently about 4.5% of what flows each year. About half of that increase is taken up annually by the surface. The rising CO2 has increased vegetation over much of the planet, and the remainder stays in the atmosphere, increasing its CO2 concentration. The situation is not unlike what we've already seen in the planet's energy flow. Small but steady human influences gradually adding to a much, much larger natural process. Global emissions of all greenhouse gases are rising rapidly, as can be seen in Figure 3.2. For the past 50 years, they've gone up 1.3% per year, though a bit more slowly, 1.1% per year, during the decade ending 2018. If the longer-term trend were to continue, emissions in 2075 would be twice as large as they are today. Nearly all of the increase in emissions has been due to CO2 from fossil fuel use. Changes in land use, such as deforestation, emit far lesser amounts of carbon stored in plants and soils. The next largest contributor after CO2 is methane, CH4, while nitrous oxide, N2O, and the fluorinated gases, F gases, such as HFCs, make up much smaller portions of the total. I don't know of any expert who disputes that the rise in CO2 concentration over the past 150 years is almost entirely due to human activities, since there are five independent lines of evidence supporting that conclusion. One is the timing of the rise. Concentrations in air samples over the past 10,000 years varied between 260 and 280 ppm before a sharp uptick began in the mid-19th century. The second is that the size of the rise is in the ballpark of what we'd expect from the CO2 emitted by burning fossil fuels. A third is that the rise in the northern hemisphere leads that in the south by about 2 years. Most fossil fuels are burned in the north, which has more land and people, and that lead is increasing as emissions grow. A fourth, more subtle confirmation comes from carbon isotopes, the relatively rare carbon atoms that are about 8% heavier than ordinary carbon atoms. About 1.1% of the Earth's carbon is the isotope 13C. The rest is the lighter isotope 12C. But the proportion of 12C and 13C isn't the same in all forms of carbon. In particular, the chemical reactions of life have a very slight preference for 12C, so that the carbon in living things, as opposed to mineral carbon in the Earth's crust, is light. That is, it has a slightly lesser proportion of 13C. Since the carbon in the atmosphere's CO2 has become progressively lighter over the decades, we can infer that it arises from the burning of fossil fuels, which, after all, were once living things. Finally, measurements over the past 3 decades have shown a tiny but detectable and steady decrease in the atmosphere's oxygen concentration. The decrease is too small to raise any concern at all about our ability to breathe, but it roughly matches what's been needed to turn the fossil carbon into CO2. As is usual in climate science, zooming out to look over geological times gives us a quite different perspective. The natural processes moving the Earth's carbon around were different in the past, so much so that by geological standards, today's Earth is starved for atmospheric CO2. Figure 3.3 shows estimates of past CO2 concentrations. The horizontal scale is geological time extending back to the Cambrian period, about 550 million years ago. The vertical axis is the ratio of past atmospheric CO2 concentrations to the average concentration over the past few million years, about 300 ppm. This particular proxy record comes from analyzing the fraction of 13C relative to 12C in carbonate sediments and paleosols, fossilized soils. Other proxies give qualitatively similar results. Only once in the geological past, the Permian period, 300 million years ago, have atmospheric CO2 levels been as low as they are today. Plant and animal life flourished abundantly during times when CO2 levels were 5 or 10 times higher than today's. But those were different plants and animals. So while carbon dioxide, in and of itself, is not particularly a concern for the planet, What is a concern is that, because life today has evolved to be well-suited to a low level of CO2, anatomically modern humans appeared only some 200,000 years ago, at the extreme right of this chart, the rapid increases of the past century might prove disruptive. Concentrations up to 1,000 ppm, 2.5 times that in open air today, are common in classrooms or auditoriums. Humans start to feel drowsy above that level. So when students start to nod off in my classroom, I like to believe it's that 1,000 ppm, not the quality of my lecture. More serious physiological effects begin above 2,000 ppm. However, if the trends of the past decade continue, it will be some 250 years before the concentration reaches 1,000 ppm, which would be at 3.3 on this chart. Carbon dioxide is the single human-caused greenhouse gas with the largest influence on the climate. But it is of greatest concern also because it persists in the atmosphere/surface cycle for a very long time. About 60% of any CO2 emitted today will remain in the atmosphere 20 years from now. Between 30 and 55% will still be there after a century, and between 15 and 30% will remain after 1,000 years. The simple fact that carbon dioxide lasts a long time in the atmosphere is a fundamental impediment to reducing human influences on the climate. Any emission adds to the concentration, which keeps increasing as long as emissions continue. In other words, CO2 is not like smog, which disappears a few days after you stop emissions. It takes centuries for the excess carbon dioxide to vanish from the atmosphere. So modest reductions in CO2 emissions would only slow the increase in concentration, but not prevent it. Just to stabilize the CO2 concentration, and hence its warming influence, global emissions would have to vanish. Methane, the second most important human-caused greenhouse gas, has also been increasing over the past century, and so also exerts a growing warming influence on the climate. Like CO2, methane concentrations, seen in Figure 3.4, show a long-term